Hey everyone, thank you so much for tuning in to another awesome episode of The Training Tales. We have a very special episode ahead for you all about marine mammal rescues, and it is a two-parter just because it's filled with so much information that we couldn't fit it all into one episode. So we really hope that you enjoy the fact that you get two episodes out of this super awesome interview. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode. Hey everyone, my name is Charlie and I am joined by my co-host Jesse in this episode, but unfortunately our little intro here had some technical issues during recording, so this is a separate recording right here. You may notice an overlap or delay in some areas of this episode, but it is an excellent and meaty interview that you definitely don't want to miss. And the best part is, it's a two-parter. So today is all about marine mammal rescues, and we are joined by an animal extraordinaire who has been there, done that in this industry for a long time, and my personal friend, Brandon Paquin. Brandon, it is so great to have you here.
Join you. Thank you for having me on. I'm excited to talk about a lot of things with you guys today.
So exciting.
Yeah.
Jesse, did you know that he used to work at DRC?
No, I did not. That is awesome. Yeah. I have no clue. When did you work there?
Oh, wow. Are you really going to make me tell you how long ago that was? I was fortunate enough to get a call from a very prominent trainer named Michael Hunt one day saying that DRC was looking to hire a male trainer to replace him because he was going to Dolphin's Quest Bermuda. And I came down and interviewed and instantly fell in love with the facility, the animals, and the people. So I started there probably the end of 96.
Okay. Oh, well, I was there. I went there in 97 or 98. And that was when I first sang with dolphins. I wonder if, I don't even know who my trainer was then, but I wonder if you were my trainer.
that means it probably was me then.
Really?
I mean, you never know. You never know. I left at the end of 98, so you never know. There's been many times where I've met people and they said, oh my gosh, I was there from this time to this time. And they go back to their pictures and there I was.
Oh,
you know, which is very cool.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, and that's how I met Charlie, was through the DRC there.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I could just talk to you for hours.
Bring it on! Bring it on!
Well, we have a couple hours. All right. Well, I know this is going to be a very full episode, so let's get right into it. Brandon, tell us a little bit about yourself and your history. What is it you do now?
Okay. Well, my passion first started with marine mammals at a very young age. I was fascinated by dolphins and whales specifically at 4 or 5 years old. So it's one of those things where it wasn't a matter of what was I going to do. It was more, when am I going to do it? You know? So starting very early with my passion, I did a lot of volunteering at wildlife rehabilitation centers, taking care of raccoons, possums, birds, things like that. And that started at 11 years old. My mom used to drop me off at a place called Jakika State Park here in South Florida by the Everglades. And I would help out with whatever they needed. You know what I mean? Just to get the time in and the experience. Then as that grew, I started doing a lot of research on just the species of cetaceans we have around here, marine mammals, all that stuff in general, and trying to build my, what's the word I'm looking for? Repertoire or education or knowledge, you know, of cetaceans, right, and marine mammals, watching every Jacques Cousteau special on every time it came on, things like that. Then I graduated high school. Hurricane Andrew hit shortly after I graduated high school. So for about a year, I was just helping my family kind of get our lives back together and things like that. And of course, my family has always known about my passion for marine mammals. And one day in the paper, there was an ad at the Miami Sea Aquarium for an apprentice trainer. And I went for it. Went in and I told them, hey, listen, anything I have to do, I don't care, I'll do it. And they said, okay, well, what do you know about sea lions, dolphins, whales? Why do you want to do this? And I basically bored them to death with these details, but they were surprised at my knowledge, you know, and got hired as an apprentice sea lion trainer.
Wow.
And kind of moved up, you know, from there. But when, as you know, Charlie, when you have a passion like that, it's not going to be long before you figure out how to get there and how to do it. That's one thing about this field is people are so extremely passionate about what they do. And I don't care what it is, with what kind of animals, you know, zoo, aquarium, pet store, you know, whatever. So that's how I got my start in it. And I was at the Miami Aquarium for about 3 years. Got to learn operant conditioning and husbandry and care for marine mammals. Moved to Metro Zoo, now Zoo Miami, for about a year and a half and gave that a shot. But I realized by that point that I was already addicted to marine mammals, so that wasn't going to work.
What did you work with there?
I started off with sea lions. Then I moved to bottlenose dolphins. Got to work a little bit with the Pacific white-sided dolphins as well.
Oh, wow.
There, but also a great mentor of mine that unfortunately just passed away this past year, Dr. Gregory Bossert, saw my passion for animal care and really brought me in and mentored me and got me to know a lot more about manatees and everything else at the park as well, you know, kind of broadened my horizons there. So that was, Charlie? That's how I got my start. And that's how I evolved into the animal care aspect.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting. So you kind of already told us how you got interested and started in this field. But what kind of schooling or training does it take to get where you are now?
Well, you see, I have to say this. One of the most important things, of course, is an education. You know, getting an education, a good education. There's many ways to do that. You know, zoology, behavior, psychology, things like that. I did it the roundabout way, and I actually do not have a degree. I did take some classes at some community colleges around, but I never actually got a degree in a specific field that pertains to marine mammal care. I was lucky.
That's amazing.
I was lucky to come into the Sea Aquarium at a very transitional time. There was a big evolution happening there from the old school to the new school. This is when husbandry training and true operant conditioning started really coming into play, because people were becoming more educated as to what it took to truly be able to care for these animals in the way that they necessarily weren't cared for before. But it was all due to, just respectfully, ignorance, just not knowing better. You know, so I tell people I went to BYU, Backyard University. it's one of those, you know, few fields that the experience that you get speaks volumes, and can keep up basically with a degree as far as the hands-on field knowledge of being around the animals and being able to apply what you learn.
For sure.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
What are some of the species you have rescued?
Oh, wow. We're jumping right into the rescue. Well, as a lot of people know, or some of those people that don't know, pygmy sperm whales, Kogia breviceps is the scientific name. It's the most commonly stranded marine mammal actually around the world. That was one of my first true experiences with rescue. So we have pygmy sperm whales, pantropical spotted dolphins, Atlantic spotted dolphins.
Oh, I love spotted dolphins.
striped dolphins, spinner dolphins. Let's see, dwarf sperm whales, which are very closely related to the pygmy sperm whales. Pilot whales, which are the short fin pilot whales that we have down here in the more temperate waters, subtropical waters down here. Rough-toothed dolphins.
Did you say bottlenose dolphins? Because I know you've at least rescued one of those.
You know, I probably skipped that over on accident because that's the most common one. So I was trying to think of the more exotic, you know, ones. But yeah, probably bottlenose dolphins more than anything as far as, you know, response, just because they are the most common cetacean found around the coastal waters here in Florida, where I've been doing most of my rescue and rehab work. That's basically it. I actually did help out with a harbor porpoise stranding up in Long Island, New York, but I lived there for a very short time and I had never really seen a harbor porpoise before and couldn't believe that this was an adult animal at 4 feet long.
They're so cute.
Adorable. They're adorable.
I have to ask, was it Jax or Louie, or was it neither? Who are you referring to?
Ooh. Tell her.
Jax or Louie?
No, tell her the most famous bottlenose dolphin that you've rescued.
Oh, a little dolphin named Winter that lives at Clearwater Marine Aquarium.
How about that? Were you on Summer's Rescue too?
I was not on Summer's Rescue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was not.
I think you were already down in the Keys at this point, right?
Correct. I was.
At Summer's Rescue? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was interesting.
So what is your favorite rescue story that you have been a part of?
Oh, wow. That's like, what's your favorite song?
I know.
You know? Well, I can tell you this. Going back to the Winter rescue, that was probably one of the most impactful as far as the outcome of the entire story and how many lives she's touched around the world and what she's done for children with prosthesis and veterans with, you know, prosthesis. There was one point in time where a hurricane came through Gulf of Mexico, went up and slammed right into New Orleans and Gulfport, Mississippi, a hurricane named Katrina, which I think you guys are familiar with.
Yes.
We all
what? Are. I've never heard of Katrina.
I was trying to be kind of a joke there, but long story short, about 12 days after the storm, I got a call from National Marine Fisheries Service. I was working at Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institution in Fort Pierce. And we got a call from fisheries saying that there were 8 dolphins that got washed out of an aquarium in Gulfport, Mississippi, Marine Life Oceanarium. And we packed up our ambulance there from Harbor Branch, got on the road, drove straight through. And it was one of the most dynamic rescues ever for many reasons. One was we weren't allowed to get in the water because the bacteria and the coliform counts were so high in the water, they wouldn't allow us to get in the water. We were actually in dry suits in the middle of September trying to reacquire these animals. But we luckily were able to locate them. Get them some food on board, get them hydrated a little bit, and you were lucky enough to be able to reacquire them and rescue them.
Wow, that is
that's
amazing.
Crazy.
Yeah, that was
all 8.
Correct. They now reside at Atlantis, the Bahamas.
Yes, mm-hmm. I do remember Jesse and I actually went to Atlantis for her bachelorette party.
Oh, very nice.
And met with the VP down there, and he kind of showed us around and everything. And I do remember him kind of telling us that some of the dolphins that were there were from the Hurricane Katrina incident.
That. Absolutely. That was wild. Definitely wild. Another fun point to that story is once we reacquired them, we really didn't have a place to set them up and stage them. So one of the first things we thought of was getting a pool filter and actually putting them in the Holiday Inn pool there in Gulfport. And we got permission from National Marine Fisheries Service. We checked the water quality. We had acquired, I think it was 3 animals the first day, and didn't acquire the rest really till about almost 8 days after, something like that. But the looks on the people's faces, all these linesmen that were fixing, you know, the power lines, the power poles and all that stuff, they come walking back into the hotel exhausted. And they go walking by this Holiday Inn swimming pool, and all of a sudden they hear, and they just stop dead in their tracks and look
around. Wow.
And like, am I really seeing this right now? You know.
Oh my goodness!
I bet you they were calling up their buddies like, "You'll never believe what the storm blew in."
Oh my goodness!
The storm blew in dolphins to this pool.
And Charlie, it's funny you say that because one of the other times that happens is we've done CT scans with animals here in the Keys, mm-hmm. and we put mm-hmm. them on a gurney and we roll them into, you know, the double doors going into the hospital, and there's a guy sitting on the phone.
A human hospital,
and the guy sitting on the phone, and all of a sudden he stops and he goes, "You're not going to believe this." You know?
Yeah, I've heard a couple places that'll do that. They say it's always super weird. Like, they go at 5 o'clock in the morning or something, yes. like that. Super early, before lots of people are there. Yes. But people find it so weird. They're at a human hospital and here comes a dolphin rolling in.
I've heard that too, Charlie. I think we heard, I don't remember who, where I heard that from. Mm-hmm. Like one of our That's stores at DRC.
Yeah.
It is fun seeing the shock on the faces, you know. Blows mm-hmm. them away.
Well, we're gonna go ahead and take a quick break right here so we can hear a word from our sponsors, and then we'll come right back. Okay. So let's get into your current organization that you're with. Who is it and what is it that they do?
Okay, well, currently I am in the Florida Keys, Marathon to be exact. That is in the Middle Keys, just north of the 7 Mile Bridge there. And I am a volunteer for the organization Dolphins Plus Marine Mammal Responder. And they are the permit holders for all of the Keys. In fact, we cover over 10,000 square miles of territory, responding to all cetacean rescues, dolphins and whales. And we do assist with manatees from time to time. Manatees are generally responded to by FWC, the state, and a couple of other facilities down here. One Dolphin Research Center, who's been doing it for years and years and years. So I'm basically on call as a volunteer, as of right now, for DPMMR. And guys, if you want to see what we do, you can go online and check that out as well. Dolphins Plus Marine Mammal Responder. You'll find that online very, very easily, of course, because we're the only thing going on down here. And speaking of that, can I go back and touch on Winter's Rescue?
Please.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that morning when I got the call, I responded with my team, but there were already responders on site from FWC, and then SeaWorld showed up shortly after that to assist as well. So she had already been untangled from the crab trap rope that was wrapped around her tail. Mm-hmm. About, what was it? About a week and a half ago, maybe not even, I responded to a male dolphin that was entangled in the same exact way by a crab trap.
Wow. Line.
And we were successful, able to respond very quickly, which is always, you know, ideal. The animal was very calm, let us approach it very easily. We were able to bring it to the boat safely, to the side of the boat, hold him there while we cut the line off, and we let him catch his breath a little bit. Just did a basic evaluation of him, his body condition, how he was breathing, his heart rate, things like that, and looking for any injuries that could be also life-threatening afterwards. Animal was released successfully. We followed him for about 45 minutes, made sure he had a good tack, and he was heading in a good direction, and not milling around or going in circles, you know. In other words, he had a a sense about himself. You know, when a marine animal, especially a cetacean, is compromised in a really bad way, they'll kind of mill around and go in circles and wander, if you will. So mm-hmm. when you release an animal like that and you see that he has a direction, he has a heading and he's heading there, that's always a good sign. So that was a success story from just in the past week and a half.
That's awesome.
That is amazing. Yeah. Yeah. So what are some of the common reasons that you are called to a rescue?
Yeah, that's a great question. When people ask me that, I tell them, listen, it's kind of like, why is somebody in the hospital? There can be a million different reasons why an animal either shows up on the beach or is compromised. And it could be anything from parasites to just being ill to essentially getting lost and then panicking. Something I've seen a lot is when cetaceans, especially deep water cetaceans, as your pilot whales, your rough-toothed dolphins, things like that, these animals are used to living in pelagic waters, you know, diving thousands of feet for their food. When they get into a shallow area like that, they start to panic. So I tell people a lot, stress is one of the biggest things we have to fight against mm-hmm. to try to keep animals alive out there. So the reasons can be, like I said, just a general illness, parasites, ingesting something foreign, being impacted, entanglements, or what we call fisheries interactions. Anytime you have an animal, a dolphin or a whale, manatee, that is tangled up in a fishing line or a rope or a net or something like that, or ingests a hook, that is considered what they call a fisheries interaction. So that is one of the reasons, and actually it's a pretty common reason, but there are so many different, you know, reasons why that would happen. Sometimes if a new mother has a calf that is not doing well, that mother will put herself in a bad position and go into an area following that calf and trying to keep that calf, you know, safe and end up in shallow water herself, you know? So that there's many different reasons, but a lot of the common ones are just general illness, and fisheries interactions.
Okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Well, what are some of the, like, biggest challenges that you do face in rescues?
Oh, wow. I have to say weather, location, and logistics. In other words, mm-hmm. cetaceans don't wait for good weather to strand.
Of course not.
And they also don't do it in the best spots either. So especially here in Florida Bay and in the Everglades, we have a very, very shallow environment. And based on the tides, we may not be able to get out to an animal as quickly as we want to because we are literally cut off from them. So when the water is high, the animal is ill or compromised in some way, they may find themselves in shallow water, shallower than normal. Mm-hmm. And we can't get into those spots sometimes where they are until the tide comes high, which is very difficult because the time between tides, you know, 6 hours, that's a long time to wait to get out to an animal. And a lot of times it can happen, you know, we'll get a report of an animal around sunset or a couple hours before sunset, and we just can't get out there before the sun starts going down.
Right.
Which is tough. So having the right equipment, being able to locate the animal, having correct information from the person that is reporting the animal is paramount. That means that means more than anything. As a matter of fact, there's an app that NOAA and National Marine Fisheries Service puts out called Dolphin and Whale 911, and you can download that in the App Store for free.
How about that?
And what it does is when you pull up the app and you see an animal, it gives you the number to call to report the animal, but it also gets you your position, your longitude, your latitude. It gives you a little brief summary so you can help identify the animal. It'll give you a run through of species, pictures, giving you length and coloration and different, you know, morphometrics about the animal that will help you identify the animal. So we know exactly what it is that we're coming to rescue.
Right.
Go ahead.
I remember when I was joining the manatee rescue team down in the Keys with Dolphin Research Center. One of the biggest things that they were talking about at that time was a lot of times you will get called out to this rescue, and the people that call it in, they have to call FWC first, and then FWC calls us, and then we have to confirm it with FWC, and then we go out. Well, a lot of times these people would call in, oh my God, there's a sick manatee, I don't know what's going on. And we would get out there, we'd send somebody out to get eyes on the manatee first. And it's just a coconut floating in the water or a buoy or something like that, that people think is a manatee. And so we're getting the whole rescue team ready for a coconut.
Charlie, what story do you want to hear about that?
Tell me whatever story you want.
I have responded to rolls of carpet underneath docks.
Oh, wow.
I have responded to inflatable dolphin beach toys. We once responded at Harbor Branch to a baby dolphin call in a little harbor, and it's like little marina. And we get the troops together, we get all the equipment on the ambulance. We get there about 2 hours away. We pull up, and I jump out and I say, okay, where's the animal? And the woman goes, oh, come over here. And she goes, oh, right there. It was a tarpon rolling.
Oh my goodness.
Gulping air. And tarpon are one of the few species that can gulp air. They can oxygenate their gills just by gulping air. And then she went, oh, and there again. And when she pointed to the second one, it was physically impossible for even an adult dolphin to make it from the first tarpon down to the second one. And you just have to, you can't roll your eyes, you can't do anything. You just have to say, oh man, that's a tarpon. You know, I'm so very sorry, but thank you so much for calling. But you have to go. That's the thing. You have to respond.
Right.
You have to go. And then what your job is, when you get there, you educate the people and you use that as an outreach, opportunity.
I love that.
You know,
just that's great.
Yeah, to educate a little more. But we always tell them, listen, if you have a question, we want you to call and take pictures always. That is very, very important. That's another thing that the app does, is it has a photo button right there, so you can take a picture of the animal and send it directly to the app. And by the way, that app, the phone number on it, as you mentioned, Charlie, it's 1-888-404-FWCC. And that is what we tell everybody to call first, because of course the chain of command is very important.
Right.
Just to weed out, you know, communication issues. And that way dispatch has a solid timeline and a solid line of communication with the rescuers and also the FWC officers that are on the water that may help us respond. And FWC is amazing. And we a lot of times can't do what we do without them.
Right.
I can't say enough about them. Yeah.
They were always so great for every rescue I went on. They were so amazing.
It's a good group of people. Yes, they are.
So what is the rescue process from the time an animal in need is spotted to when they are back to the wild and healthy?
Ooh, okay. The Cliff Notes version of that. when an animal is first spotted, the first thing we do is we send somebody out to assess the situation, to put eyes on the animal, to get confirmation on the species, the size, the condition of the animal, also an idea of the environment and what tools we're going to need to be able to best respond to that stranded animal. You know, so do we need kayaks? Is it in a super shallow area? Do we need boats that have a little more power to them because it's in deeper water? What tools are we going to need with the animal? Is it too large to be able to just basically scoop them up and go? Or are we going to have to set up a triage area and set up tents and, you know, set up a small area where we get the animal stabilized? That's a big part of it, stabilizing the animal, making sure that he just gets a chance or she gets a chance to rest, calm down, and kind of gather their wits a little bit as we make a better plan as to where we're going to transport the animal for rehabilitation. Once the animal is transported to the facility where it's going to be rehabilitated. It is a painstaking, very, very expensive, all hands on deck type thing. Mm-hmm. Usually we don't sleep for the first 48 hours when an animal comes in, because we need to be there with that animal, constantly. If the animal is responding well to the rehabilitation, it depends on the species of the animal. It depends on the age of the animal. It depends on the size of the animal. It's a very balanced thing between getting trust and building a relationship enough to where the animal will trust you to do the procedures you need to do to keep it alive. Feeding, administering medications, exercise, enrichment, things like that. But you also want to not develop too much of a relationship, in the sense that we don't want them to start depending on us. So it's a very, very fine line. And with a green animal, what we call a green animal or a green cetacean, meaning that they've never seen a person before, they've never worked with a person or been around a person before, it's a very, very fine line. And it's very unique. And that's one of the things I love about what I do the most, is building that trust, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Building that communication. Now, after that animal has been rehabilitated successfully, the animal's situation or status will be reviewed by an expert board of biologists on National Marine Fisheries Board, and then they will together make the best decision as to how the animal will be reintroduced back to the wild, where. Also, of course, the veterinarians are piping in on that and making their oh man, I'm drawing a blank. Their points, you know, mm-hmm. met and seen. So it's very unique, you know. It's very hard to explain a certain situation, and that's another thing that I absolutely love about that, is every single animal and every situation is completely different. I've been doing this off and on most of my life for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And the more I learn, the more questions I have, and the more I realize I don't know.
Yeah.
Always with working with the animals.
They're the best teachers.
You know what I mean? They are. They definitely are. So if an animal is deemed releasable, when they do that, it doesn't just stop there. They don't just go and drop the animal off. A lot of times we will fit them with a radio tag, telemetry, or a satellite tag, so we are able to follow the animal's progress as it goes. It's not just dropped off there. There's a lot of investment that goes in that animal.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay. Yeah. And who
that was my question.
Them non-releasable, if that is the case.
I'm sorry, you broke up there a little bit.
Non-releasable? Would that be the board? Would the board, is that who would deem them non-releasable if that had to be the case, if they had to stay in human care?
Yes. This panel from National Marine Fisheries Service consists of experts that have been in this field, and I'm talking about published veterinarians, biologists, behavioralists, pathologists, that have a lot of experience and know what the best course of action is for that animal and its survival. Of course, we always want to, release an animal, back out to its natural habitat, but realistically, sometimes that doesn't happen. And in my opinion, I believe that it's important for us to be able to work with these animals as much as we possibly can, especially one that, came to us by way of stranding and not, born at a facility somewhere, because we can learn a lot about its physiology, its behavior, things like that help us do better.
For sure.
The next time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. What would deem an animal non-releasable?
Well, the biggest one, of course, is age.
Mm-hmm.
We unfortunately we get young animals in, mm-hmm. and as you know, cetaceans, most of them being extremely social animals, they depend on that pod for survival, for capturing food, defense from predators. So if an animal does not have the local knowledge of where they have come from, we are not dolphins. We cannot teach them how to do that.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. In other words, I can take a wolf as a puppy, raise him, but I'm not going to drop him back in the wild because, one, he doesn't know how to be a wild wolf. He doesn't know how to interact with other packs that he might come across. He doesn't have the local knowledge of where their threats are, also where their food
Absolutely.
Is.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that are super specific, not only to just pods of say dolphins in an area, mm-hmm. but to individual groups based on where they feed. Those animals have learned how to feed on a specific prey item in a specific way, and this has been passed on from great great grandmothers on up through the pod. So it's knowledge that is known and passed on. It's like me saying, okay, well, people live in Africa. I'm gonna take you. I'm gonna give you a spear, and I'm gonna drop you off in Africa. Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Have fun.
Absolutely,
you can make it. People live in Africa. You know, so it's extremely important for these animals not only to have other animals to be with for protection, but also to feed themselves.
Right.
You know, so
now real quick, I know this was like a question or two ago where we were talking about the rescue process from the time an animal is in need. And you were talking about, you have somebody that goes out and assesses the dolphin and really gets a good idea of what the animal is like, what condition it's in. Now, I learned something sure. from you way back when we went on a call, and you had told me there's a body scoring condition. Can you go over the difference 4 points?
Sure, sure. Okay, well, a body conditioning is basically just looking at an animal and saying, okay, well, I can tell this animal is either super healthy, in between, a little skinny, or emaciated.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll score that from a 1 to a 5.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways you can tell that as well is when you come up on an animal that's like that. I talked about the peanut head, Charlie. Remember I showed mm-hmm. you? I said his post. There's a pad right behind the skull of bottlenose dolphins, and it's called the postnuchal fat pad. And it's kind of like blubber or the fat pad on a camel, although it doesn't really store the moisture as it does in a camel. Mm-hmm. It's more of calories. So when a bottlenose dolphin is not doing well and they score badly, you can start to see that postnuchal fat pad recede and go down. So we call it a peanut head. You will actually see the shape of the skull because that postnuchal fat pad has been eaten away because the animal has been processing
mm-hmm.
and using it as food. So that is a big way to say, hey, listen, this animal is really compromised, or he looks good. He just either got lost or chased fish into an area that was too shallow, which happens a lot too. We have animals that just go after mullet in a too shallow of an area and they get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
Wow.
So that would be like a 2 or a 3.
Right out in the middle. It depends. If you have a 1, he's great. 2, all right. 3, starting to get a little skinny. 4, 5, not doing too well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I remember that. We came up on the 5.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, he was an old man, if you remember. Mm-hmm. His teeth were almost filed down completely flat. He was a great, great, great grandpa.
Yep.
No doubt in my mind.
All right. So
no doubt in my mind.
So right now, we're going to go ahead and break this episode into two parts.
Okay.
So we'll take a quick break here. And then for you viewers, you'll hear back from us next week. But really for us, it's going to be a matter of like 5 seconds.
Thank you so much for joining us on part one of this awesome interview with Brandon Paquin, all about marine mammal rescues. If you're enjoying this as much as we are, please leave a rating or review and give us a follow on Facebook and Instagram at The Training Tales. Also, if you have any comments or suggestions, please feel free to message us there or email us at thetraininggtails@gmail.com. That's thetrainingtales@gmail.com. We are so grateful for all of you, and we can't wait to talk to you again next week. But until then, peace out, everybody.